Let's return to Ecclesiastes chapter 6. Ecclesiastes chapter 6. We look to finish up chapter 6 today. We've got to move on. Throughout the chapter still, we've been kind of seeing the pessimistic view of Solomon as he has looked at life and experienced so much in life. A lot of what's been said here in the first few chapters is kind of a dismal view of life. Life is meaningless, vanity of vanities. Seems to be something he has said over and over again. So we're getting to the seventh chapter. There's a little bit of a change of gears, so to speak, as we get into that chapter, and as the format changes a little bit. But we're still finishing up here this latter part of chapter 6 and kind of reviewing where we've been. And through chapter 6, I mean, some conclusions that it seems as though Solomon is drawing when you're trying to find success and happiness in life. It's like, you know, he said, more children are not the answer. Here was one who seemingly had a lot of children and seems to have some concern that life may come to an end and not even your children will remember to bury you in a proper way. That's going to be a concern that he had. More years were not the answer, because the longer you live, basically you say, the more trouble you have to deal with in life. So just wishing for more years is not the answer for happiness. More work is not the answer, because the harder you work, the more hard work there is to do. Now, he has drawn some conclusions along the way that there are some things we can enjoy from the work of our hands, and that we should enjoy that. But still, in the big picture, just more work is not the answer to happiness in life. Wisdom. Even more wisdom is not the answer. And here's one that the Lord has given much wisdom to. And he says, just having great wisdom, that's not the answer to happiness in life. Truth is a benefit. Real truth, he says, can be just a real benefit. And there can be some joy found in that. As we get to the latter part here of the chapter, we're looking at verses 7 following. Still kind of reviewing those points right there, verse 7. You know, we talked about this somewhat Wednesday night, where the playing field is leveled out some, whether one is rich or one is poor, whether one works in industry or one scratches the soil, you know, makes to make a means of living. It's still just a matter of man has to eat, and that there's work that has to be done to eat. And then you have to, once you gain strength from eating, you have to go back to work so you can earn some more so you can eat again. It's like he's saying there's just a cycle to life here that just goes on and on. And it's like he's saying there's got to be more to life than this. Verse 8, what advantage has a wise man over a fool? What does a poor man gain by knowing how to conduct himself before others? And it's like he's saying, is it better to be wise or is it better to be a fool? You know, is there really an advantage one to another? Well, he's already indicated through some previous chapters that while on one hand wisdom can just be much folly, there is, on the other hand, some benefits to being wise. You know, so he keeps running back and forth with all these various ideas. What really makes the difference in life? What really matters anyway? Well, in verse 9 he says, better what the eye sees than the roving of the appetite, because this too is meaningless and chasing after the wind. That's a hard phrase to me to think about and try to understand. But I think the idea of that is the truth of what we see is right before us. Sometimes we need to not look any farther than what's right before us, or to see and to do and to enjoy what's right before us. Better what the eye sees than the roving of the appetite. Sometimes we can dream so much about what's more and what else we can have, what else we want to do, that we forget to see what's right in front of us. A little bit like the old saying, a bird in the hand is better than two in the bush. And it seems a little ironic to me that here this wise king, who had everything and yet was still grasping to find something more to the meaning of life, and was looking and dreaming always of what can be done next, and what can I do, and what can be accomplished. For a long time, it seems, missed what was really most important in life that was right before him, that was right in front of him the whole time. Sometimes I think we should relate to that. But sometimes what is most beautiful in life is what is right in front of us, and yet we don't take the time to see or enjoy what's right there in front of us. It's that dream, it's having that appetite of looking beyond and wanting something more all the time. But there's something to be said about finding what's enjoyable in life right now. Back in chapter 5 and verse 18, he says, "Then I realized that it is good and proper for a man to eat and drink and to find satisfaction in his toilsome labor under the sun during the few days that God has given him." This is his lot. Again, it's kind of the idea of just seeing and enjoying what's in front of you, you know, at the time, to enjoy life now. I think, really, as we get to the closing part of chapter 6, Solomon is drawing conclusions. We've said as we've kind of come through, he just kind of seems to be looking at the life, the different paradigms of life, this side to that side. But he has drawn some conclusions as we've gone through. There are more to come. We get to chapter 7 and moving forward, it seems as though he starts drawing more conclusions about life and what it is and what is good. But I think even we're seeing that enough in some things that he is saying here. We're looking at verse 10 here, as it kind of left off on Wednesday night. Let's look at this and then probably have some discussion about some of these points right here. Whatever exists has already been named, and what man is has been known. No man can contend with one who is stronger than he. The more the words, the less the meaning. And how does that profit anyone? He's talking about, what are some points that can be drawn from this right here? What's the conflict, perhaps, that's being seen? Whatever exists has already been named. And what man is has been known. No man can contend with one who is stronger than he. Think about that a little bit. What are some conclusions we can work on?
First thing that comes to my mind is there are just some things you cannot change. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if that's the author's point, but that seems to be the sense.
Mm-hmm. I think that's part of it, dude. What else?
It seems like people are always saying the good old days, boy, it'd be great to live back in the 50s or the early 1900s or whatever. They had their definite problems. Mm-hmm. We will
sure.
Never know the sure depth of, because every generation has gone through troubling times.
Always has
it's
been.
It's not peculiar to man.
Sure. All right. What else can you say with that? It seems to be part of it. Go ahead.
Well, it seems to me like in the academia world, they're always finding something new. Mm-hmm. And the more they find it's new, the more they find it already was.
Yeah.
It,
nobody's saying.
That sounds like it.
It sounds like that's part of what Solomon's saying here. But what goes along with that is the second part. No man can contend with one who is stronger than he. Who was stronger than Solomon? I mean, Solomon was a great king, a powerful king, the kind of king that others came to just get a bit of his wisdom. Afraid to fight against Solomon. Nobody fought against Solomon all those years. You know, who was stronger than Solomon? Well, Solomon knew who was stronger than he. I think it's a reference to God here. You know, is the idea. And when you think of it that way, whatever exists has already been named, and what man is has been known. No man can contend with one who is stronger than he. Why would we contend with God? Well, why would we try to fight and argue with God?
We do it all the time.
We do. And this is the problem. We try to fight against God all the time. We really do. We say, "Oh no, I don't." Yeah, we do. When we are not willing to submit to His will, when we're not willing to submit to His plan and see what His plan is for the life of man, then yes, we are contending with God. What about Solomon? Did he have some problems with that?
Sure.
Yeah, as we learned more and more about his life, it seemed as life went on, the farther he got away from God. Ecclesiastes doesn't really reveal as much to us as the documentary of the life of Solomon does. As we go through the Kings and the Chronicles and we read about his life, it seems that by the end of his life, he had moved far from God. And yet, maybe this is what was written near the very end of his life. And as he's kind of pulling life together and realizing that you can't contend with God. What is has always been. We can't change some certain things in life. We need to accept some things as they are. That seems to me, at least, to be part of what he is talking about here. You know, the idea that God is in charge. Wouldn't you think that for a king that has enjoyed the power that Solomon has had, that there would be the temptation to think that there was nothing or no one that was stronger than you?
I see it all the time.
Yeah. Still some with problems such as that. And yet, maybe here, he's coming to some conclusions about what is really most important. Verse 12, where he says, "For who knows what is good for a man in life? During the few meaningless days he passes through like a shadow. Who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he is gone?" You know, no man can know by his own searching what is in his future. What will tomorrow bring? We may have some thoughts, we may have some plans, but how often do our plans come out to be nothing at all? Or our day comes out nothing at all as we had planned. Solomon sees that, and he's understanding that. I'm afraid so often we do contend with God. And it seems, to some extent, that's what Solomon had been doing as well. And the idea of contending with God is just not being willing to fully submit what he says in his will. In our work, there were several passages that were given. I thought this really helped kind of bring the point front. I think it's David who said, "Cease striving and know that I am God." David did. It is what God was saying. Don't forget that I'm God. Just accept that. Isaiah penned, "Woe to the one who quarrels with his maker. Will the clay say to the potter, 'What are you doing?'" We know the clay doesn't tell the potter what to do. It's the other way around. It's that way with our relationship with God. When are we going to learn that? When are we going to just accept that? You know, to argue with God is what C.S. Lewis says, not the Bible. That's a key point, I thought. To argue with God is to argue with the very one who makes it possible to argue at all. That makes sense. So true. And verse 12. I mean, a couple of questions that have to come into our mind that are written here. "For who knows what is good for a man in life? During the few and meaningless days he passes through like a shadow." Well, who knows?
God knows.
God knows. God knows. Who can tell him what will happen after the sun, under the sun, after he is gone? Who can tell us? God can. God knows. And so it's sort of like Solomon's finally come to this point of saying, you know, it doesn't matter what you accomplish in this life. It doesn't matter who you are, if you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter if you're powerful or if you're weak. You know, you think about all the things that you said coming up here, all the different perspectives, the paradigm from one side to another. And when it comes to the end, you know, it's like he's saying, you know, who knows what's good in life? You know, how can, during the few and meaningless days of our life, who knows what's really going to happen in our life? God knows. Why would we contend with God? Seems to be what he's saying
there. Yeah. He'd been promised a kingdom that would last and last as long as.
Mm-hmm.
And he had no idea. He was working to accomplish that. That was his goal to maintain.
Mm-hmm.
Now he drifted from that goal. But the idea was, we're going to have this thing last for 1,000 years. Didn't make it through the next king.
Mm-hmm.
So
because they moved so far away from God.
So the concept is that you take care of what you can take care of now,
mm-hmm.
and do the right things now.
Right.
And what happens in the future? Well, you've done the best with what you've done the best that you can do now, and you can't try to control the future. You can just do the best with what you've got at this point in time.
You think Solomon is starting to understand that all Anything about the brevity of life?
Oh, yeah.
And here's this man with all these riches, everything this world has to offer, and he's saying the few remaining years of this life will pass like a shadow. I mean, that's his perspective of what he has, man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As he's getting older, now he's starting to realize, you know, that life is coming to him. How old do you have to be to start realizing that this life is short? I mean, that's kind of a funny question, but it's kind of a real one too. I mean, really think about that. I mean, at what age did you really start realizing and thinking, phew, this life's really going fast? You know?
I think when parents start passing away, it hits you like a ton of bricks.
You know, that's exactly one of the thoughts. I mentioned the other night, you know, like, my mother died when she was young. She was 54 years old. She was what my age is now. She was 54 years old when she died. And that was just a reality hitting home kind of thing, where you start thinking that, wow, life really goes fast, you know. I mean, that was one point. It was just a couple of years later, when I turned 35, you know, you think about what the psalmist says, you know, you're 70 years, kind of an average lifespan of a man. And at 35, I'm thinking, I'm halfway there. And I'm thinking, I'm just a kid, but I'm halfway there. And it does kind of seem like things have been sliding downhill pretty fast since that time, you know? I mean, what for you, I mean, at what point did you start thinking, this life is short?
There's a mathematical concept in there. For a 5-year-old waiting from one Christmas to the next Christmas.
Forever,
20% of his life. For us, one Christmas to the next Christmas.
I can't believe it was just Christmas.
For life.
It was just Christmas. And here's Christmas again. Yeah, you're right. It goes faster and faster.
I remember having thoughts about, you know, when I was in college and thinking that, you know, the girls' parents I was dating were old, and then I realized, wait a second, they're younger than I am now. and that's the sort of perspective that things change so quickly.
I remember when my dad turned 40 years old, and we had a little party surprise for my dad on his 40th birthday. I was 13 at the time. And I can remember when dad came in the room, surprise, and some brethren there, and kinfolk and stuff, and I remember kind of standing back and thinking, 40 years old, that's 40 years old. I guess we won't have him much longer. I remember thinking that. He's 82 now, and I'm far past 40. But just perspective, isn't that something? And here we saw, you know, there just seems to be some perspective in life that's coming together. I mean, you can see this all the way through the book of Ecclesiastes. And why we can't understand what Solomon was saying in the latter part of his life, if we just read this book enough and understand the wisdom that is in it, you know, the priorities that need to be set in life. He struggled with that throughout his life. And it seems, or at least I guess we're hoping, because Solomon had walked far away from God in so many ways, if this was, in fact, one of the last things he wrote, perhaps there was this movement back to God. Maybe that's wishful thinking on my part. I don't know. But there's some lessons to be learned. As we get into chapter 7, there is, it seems to be, a little bit of kind of a, you know, a shifting of gears, so to speak, that takes place as we get into this chapter. There are more of like proverbs, I guess, is what I'm thinking. Short statements. You know, where in the earlier chapters there was longer statements that maybe came to a conclusion. And here, at least in chapter 7, we find more of like what we find in the proverbs, kind of short statements that you can draw some conclusions from. You know, as you go through. I mean, it's still sound counsel for life, you know, as we look at these things. But there is kind of a change in writing styles that takes place here. You know, he has been describing up to this point the futility of life under the sun. And we've kind of seen that, and we've made some points of that as we've come through. Everything he was viewing life in so many ways of perspective was life under the sun. This is meaningless. It's vanity. This doesn't mean anything. It was all from the view of life under the sun. And it seems like in the chapters going forward from here, he's taking a little bit different view. He's kind of stepping back. He's trying to look at life, you know, life above the sun. God's perspective, so to speak. You know, it's just kind of a different view of that. The terms wise and wisdom occur like 30 times or so in chapter 7 and going, you know, here are some wise things, here are some wise conclusions that need to be made, or and perhaps this is going back to some previous statements. Maybe this is why I have some hope for Solomon, that in the latter part of his life there was some change. There was a shift that moved him closer to God as he started using that wisdom that God had blessed him with to draw some sound conclusions in life and to pull him or draw him nearer to God. And so we look here in verse 1, or chapter 7, verse 1. We'll read the first 3 verses or so. A good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. For death is the destiny of every man. The living should take this to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, because a sad face is good for the heart. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. You can break down each of those verses. Some of them, there's kind of like 2 different thoughts given in the verse. A good name is better than a fine perfume. What do you think he's talking about? A good name is better than a fine perfume. What do you think he's saying?
Perfume is temporal.
Yeah. And perfume is temporal and temporary. I mean, it's something that's pleasant of this life. And you know, if you find a kind of perfume, you put that on tomorrow, you got to put it on again. I mean, it doesn't really last. Right? What else? What's it say about having a good name? What's the point? What is that?
Your character.
Yeah, your character. Something about having, there's a benefit to having a good name that will last longer than any good perfume you put on. What would you say to that? What are the comments you would make with that?
Don't lose it.
Easy to lose a good name, isn't it? In fact, it seems to be easier to gain a bad reputation than a good one. And it's certainly harder to hold on. A good name. What makes for a good name? What's the character's traits?
Honesty.
Honesty.
Trustworthy.
Trustworthy. Integrity.
Humility.
Humility.
Sure. You can somewhat say something that's seeking after God.
Absolutely, yeah. All the traits we've mentioned are all part of godliness, actually. All necessary for one who seeks to be godly. And when you start thinking about what's more valuable, you have some very expensive perfume here, or a good reputation, what is really more valuable? Well, the reputation is what is more valuable.
The perfume is used to cover up.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thought. Yeah. Sometimes you can cover up a lot of stink with perfume.
That's the idea, I think.
Yeah.
But the
particularly
the name doesn't need to be covered up.
Yeah, that's right. You ever tell your kids when they're going out somewhere, remember who you are? Remember your name? Something to that effect? You know? Well, as the people of God, sometimes we just need to remember who we are. So Solomon's point here is, I think, a rather simple one. So, you know, this part, a good name is better than a fine perfume, that's not too hard to figure out.
A good perfume can be bought, but a good reputation cannot be bought.
Oh, yeah, good point. Yeah. I mean, even with some money, if I can go down to the store and buy a good perfume, but go down there and look on the shelf for good reputation, buy one of those. Yeah, you can't get it.
Have tried.
Yes, people have tried. Which tells us a whole lot about their reputation again.
Yes.
You know. All right. So we got this part, a good name is better than a fine perfume. What about this? And the day of death is better than the day of birth? All right, how do you figure that? I mean, how can the day of death be better than the day of birth? I mean, that doesn't sound right. That doesn't sound normal.
Well, it's
point.
It's only right if you have lived a faithful life to God.
We don't have to fear death if we're the people of God. Right? Good. What else?
The date of our birth is a birth from our mother's womb into this world, mm-hmm. which is an awesome thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the date of our death is the birth into the next world,
eternity.
Which is God's creation.
It's
far superior
than
any shock value that the earth has.
Absolutely. Good.
When you tie it in with the other verses, the follow though almost looks like he's approaching things pessimistically.
It does take a turn that way, but I think there's an optimistic conclusion that's wrong. But when we think of death, and even as he has thought of death, it's usually not in a favorable way.
But here he's saying, if you're being born, you've got all the hardships and all the trials of life ahead of you.
Yeah.
And when you die, you don't have to worry about those anymore.
Yeah.
So the matter's concluded.
Yeah, that's right. The matter's concluded, and we're moving on from here. And if it's with a godly focus, a godly life, moving on from here is a good thing. Okay?
But in these verses, verses 2, 3, 4, he's telling us that we need to prepare for that end. It's not just that it's going to be the birth, but we better be ready for that rebirth into a new kingdom.
Yeah. It seems to me the idea here of some learning that can have to take place as we view that day of death. Because, I mean, he's already said enough at this point in Ecclesiastes, coming to this point, that death is obvious, death is imminent. Death is going to come to all. You know, it doesn't matter if you're popular or if you're not popular. It doesn't matter if you're rich or if you're poor. It doesn't matter if you're powerful or if, in the eyes of man, if you're weak. I mean, think about all those analogies. I mean, that have been made over and over and over again. It doesn't matter who you are. You know, you're going to die. If you have been born, you are going to die. You know, and this is part of some conclusions here that is coming about. And there's something for us to learn from death. Now, that's maybe somewhat hard for us because I don't think most of us walk around too much dwelling on death. In fact, we probably do our best to not dwell on death. You know, we're trying to just live life. But there's something that we can learn from death. Death has more to teach us. Someone said, death has more to teach us than the day of birth. And that the lessons of death are more factual and vital to us. I thought that was a good statement. You know, and that makes a lot of sense. Because when we get old enough to start realizing that we've been born, we are alive, we must have a view on death. And there's some things we should learn from that. The thought, I think, continues on in verse 2. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. For death is the destiny of every man, and the living should take this to heart. What else would you say about living and death when you consider that?
Well, sad times has a tendency to teach us more than happy times.
Yeah.
It gets our attention.
It's our attention. There's some reality. You know, from time to time, I have preached funerals for people that I didn't even know. That's always a little bit weird. But sometimes there's members of the church who have kinfolk who passed away. They weren't religious people, perhaps. Somebody needs to say something. Or even from time to time, I've had the funeral home call and say, would you have the time to be willing to come and do a funeral? We talk about really not knowing somebody or knowing anybody there. But somebody needs to say something. You know, what do you say? And at first, I just really just avoided that and hated to be in that position. But as time went on, I started to realize usually people in that position, whoever are gathered there, are not spiritual people, they're not religious people. And then nobody there. Wow, what an opportunity to preach. You sort of have a captive audience. And you can preach about what is life and what is death and where can we find hope even in death. You can talk about those things. And for a few minutes, people are actually sitting there thinking about and contemplating death and what's after death. And isn't that what Solomon is really talking about right here? That we need to think about and contemplate those things. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. Or where would we rather go? Well, we'd rather go to the house of feasting. Of course. That's what we would rather do. But is that the best thing for us? Solomon says, no, it's not. Because you go to the house of mourning, it puts your mind in a completely different state. A completely different place. For death is the destiny of every man. Let's not be fooled about it. We're all going to die. And the living should take this to heart. The psalmist said in the 90th Psalm, teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. Sometimes we just have to be reminded, and there is nothing that reminds us any more than when we are standing at the casket looking at the deceased. It's reality that we're going to die. And there are lessons to be learned in death. Solomon's getting at that point in that age where maybe he was seeing that, and he was thinking that way too.
Thing is, when you're born, you're not in sin yet, but at some point you will sin.
That's
you
true
will
too.
Be tempted, and mm-hmm. you will suffer various ways. But when you die, if you've been a Christian, you've been faithful, you're finally released from all that.
Sure.
So that's a release. And those that are left behind, depending on where they're at, when they're standing at that casket of that loved one, that may make an impression on them that, you know, if they're, particularly if their life is messed up, do they want to be with mom or dad later, or do they want to be at the other end of eternity?
Right.
And you can learn a lot more from that.
And you can make this point, too. I mean, you can go to the house of feasting. How long will that last? You can go to a party. In a few hours, that party is over. When it comes to death, that's eternal. You know, that this body comes to an end. But what then? The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. But the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. The wise thinks about and prepares for the end of this life. And so, just some powerful thoughts there. It's
you've mentioned about preaching sermons to people you've never known anything about. We called my brother together, and I said, he said, well, I don't usually preach those, but, you know, he said, look at it like this. He said, the opportunity to teach people that preparation for death is there.
Mm-hmm.
Those people that's there know that they see.
That's right.
I'll be prepared
right.
to meet God. And that's a lot of what he's saying here.
I think so.
And that's what I do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. All right. All right. Good thoughts. Good thoughts. Let's look at the next little segment here, being in verse 5. It says, it is better to heed a wise man's rebuke than to listen to the song of fools. Like the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of fools. This too is meaningless. Extortion turns a wise man into a fool, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Right. A little bit of shifting of gears, different view here on some things as being considered. Better to heed a wise man's rebuke. Who likes being rebuked or given instruction? Sometimes it seems we really resist. Sometimes we don't want to hear those things. But, you know, wisdom comes to us in different ways. I mean, there's instruction that comes to us in different ways. Some of it's helpful, some of it is not. And here the emphasis, it seems to be, from from Solomon is that you need to listen to a wise man. Well, how do you know who is the wise man? Now, how do you know who to listen to? There is a comparison made that it's better to heed a wise man's rebuke than to listen to the song of fools. What's the comparison? How do we know the difference? What's the analogy that's being made?
Rebuked. Suggests contemplation, observation, consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Song, it's just plain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's particularly a song of fools, which implies what? What does that say?
Superficial, it's empty.
Yeah. It lacks meaning. You know, there's always a fool who can tell you how to live life or how to, here's what you should do in life, you know. But when you stand back and look at their life, you realize they can't get their own life right. I mean, have you seen people like that? I mean, someone whose life is just totally messed up, but they're the ones that seem to have the most advice for you on what you need to do in your life. You know, it's like, well, stop and think about that for a minute.
The ones that are always saying, follow your heart.
Yes.
Yeah. Follow the truth.
Yeah.
The analogy here of thorns that have popped this morning and last night, this morning, prime example. Anyone who's ever tried to heat their house with wood fire. You can heat up a poppy with thorns, but it's not like it. It'll flash, flare, pop, crackle, snap, and in minutes gone. Worthless. Nothing but ash. You load it up with the backlog of oak or something along those lines. It's more substantial, stays with you, more productive in the long run.
Like the crackling of thorns that are in the pot, so is the laughter of fools. It's not going to last. There's no substance there. It's not going to last. Burning those little twigs of thorns is not going to be of any substance at all. Listen to the wise men. You know.
Yeah. The thing about the rebuke, when we open the pages of God's Word and we read it, if we're not rebuked in something in our lives,
sure,
then we're not reading it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's true.
Yeah. But we're talking about receiving wise counsel, of course. God's word is going to be what gives us the best.
You know, a song is only going to benefit you for a few minutes more than likely. You're going to receive some pleasure and enjoyment from that. But a rebuke from a wise man can benefit you for a lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Good thoughts.
When I think back on some of the lyrics of the songs that I listened to in the 60s and 70s when I was growing up, just utterly ridiculous lyrics. You know, and I think of Elvis singing, I did it my way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what did that get you? Doing it God's way is the way to do it.
Yeah, yeah. That's good. Mr. Larson.
I just want to say, if we remember what the instructions are, or what God gave Solomon, we can read in the scripture. We have God's word in the scripture.
That's right.
And Solomon's wisdom was more than anyone.
He's being led by God.
Right. And nobody was going to follow him with any more wisdom than he
had. Right.
So what wisdom that we can read the details of us in here.
It's
he has recognized during his lifetime that
things have come full circle on some
plantation. Right. And we need to really pay attention to what he has told us. That benefits us forever.
Right.
Usually when someone rebukes you, you know you've done wrong.
Yeah. They don't make us like it anymore, but you're right.
And you listen to someone tell you something that makes you feel good.
That's not going to be as helpful.
That's right. It's better to wake up to the fact that you're doing wrong, you know it, but
and just
don't
admit it.
Face it.
That's right. Face it. That's exactly right. Good thoughts, y'all. Lord willing, Winston Everett will take up right there. Those who can't, let's put it up close to the front.